So tonight's not hugely serious subject is 7 reasons why you shouldn't watch The Walking Dead on TV. I'm sure there are lots of socialists who are all high-minded aesthetes, and they spend their evenings practicing the cello and reading Chaucer and watering their orchids and things. And I do actually know one or two socialists who don't even have a TV in the house. That's very admirable. I'm ashamed to say that I watch telly most nights like a sort of deranged junkie. And especially during the pandemic, box set dramas. You know, those dramas that go into several series all in a box. I'm even quite often quite nerdy about it. I watch the show on one computer screen, and I have the Internet Movie Database up on another screen so I can look up what else the actors have been in. So that's what kind of TV junkie I am. Now, I've already been asked by one or two people what on earth this Walking Dead thing is. They've never heard of it, which is sort of a bit of a surprise because this is one of the biggest shows in the world. It's been networked all over the world. It's not quite up to Game of Thrones level or anything that that big, but it's still pretty famous. It's more famous than most shows, and it's been going for 12 years. It's gone through 10 series. So for all of those who have no idea what I'm talking about, the premise of The Walking Dead is dead simple. It's the zombie apocalypse. So civilization has been destroyed because of some obscure virus, and the few survivors have to contend with a landscape that's stalked by the undead who shuffle around. These are zombies. They shuffle around and trying to bite your neck and turn you into one of them, basically. So you've probably seen films like this. As a bit of a neat twist, the original, the virus that created the zombies also means that whenever anyone dies, they also turn into a zombie. So this spices up sort of funerals and loved ones' parting words, because they have to be accompanied by a sort of ice pick through the brain, which is how you kill zombies in the show. Okay, so pretty stupid, and obviously, therefore, a smash hit worldwide. So, first of all, here's why it's a good show. It's not some simple us versus them shoot 'em up. You know, they race around the countryside shooting at zombies. That would get old very quickly. And the zombies are not actually the story. They're sort of part of the backdrop, if you like, the general hostile environment. The real story is the characters. And these stories these characters have got dimensionality and depth. There's a very satisfying level of moral ambiguity and compromise. It's not just a question of two-dimensional goodies and baddies. These are mostly good and decent people who are often impelled to do bad things, and vice versa. So so the innocent sometimes suffer, the guilty sometimes go free. The script is well written, it's sharp and focused. Scenes are rarely wasted, plots are not flabby, relationships are well developed, and there's real emotional investment in often quite likeable characters. So if one of them gets killed off, you feel it like a blow. Okay, so why it works as a series? Because the story isn't wrapped up with a neat, contrived, little tidy bow at the end of 2 hours like a film is. The questions that it deals with are ongoing, like life itself, and endings can spawn consequences which then produce new conflicts. So in a way, it works as a sort of parable of living in capitalism. It's the ultimate conflict society, if you like. The setup strips away the varnish of civilization and asks you some sort of basic questions like, what are you really like underneath? What might you be prepared to do in a situation if your survival depended on it? Now, some people here, the more ancient among us perhaps, will be reminded of the 1970s series Survivors by Terry Nation of Daleks fame. Now, this was like the evil twin of The Good Life, and both shows actually ran concurrently. I'm not sure what if anything this says about the 1970s. Now, the contrast is not dissimilar to that between the Swiss Family Robinson on the one hand and Lord of the Flies on the other hand. You see what I mean about dark twins. I was just reading the other day that the BBC, during the pandemic, it's dragged out tons and tons of old box sets of shows from the 1980s and the 1970s even, put them all on iPlayer. But it hasn't dragged out the original Survivors 3-series box set. If you're wondering why not, well, it's because there's a pandemic on, and clearly at the BBC they have a sense of decorum and taste. Interestingly, they remade the Survivors series in 2008. I don't know if anybody saw that. It was a bust, basically. Audiences didn't go for it. Why not? I tried to watch it. I thought the characters were boring and two-dimensional. But I found a quote from the writer himself, which is actually quite telling. What the writer said afterwards was, he said, "The only thing we didn't do is reflect how kind and how decent people are." And he's talking about today's pandemic. And he says, "Certainly on a day-to-day basis, I think we've behaved wonderfully well in this crisis. In that show, we kind of skipped the people being kind bit." That was his explanation for why his own show tanked. Now, there's a kind of genealogy here, because 8 months after Survivors closed, the remake was cancelled, a new US zombie apocalypse show started. This was Walking Dead. It was a smash hit, now in its 10th series. And one of the things it didn't fail to do was make its characters kind and decent. And there is a lot of that in the show. Okay. So if I've been in danger of puffing it up a little bit too much, here are some reasons why I said not to watch it. So 7 reasons. So first of all, and probably least important of all, is that in my opinion, zombies are shit anyway. They only shuffle around at the speed of a pensioner with a Zimmer frame. But in spite of that, it's amazing how often characters in the show get caught and eaten by them. There was a spate of films where zombies ran fast, which is kind of cheating and also a sort of revisionism. And this show, Walking Dead, prefers the sort of classic zombie shuffle. But the thing is about zombies, I don't really get the movie obsession with them. I get it with vampires. Vampires make sense. Marx talks about vampires. You sort of get it in capitalism. Werewolves, yeah, maybe. They offer a sort of framework for exploring the sort of dark duality of the human mind, you know, sort of Jekyll and Hyde type thing. Frankenstein, sure, why not? A comment on the human fear of science. Probably deserves to make a comeback in this day and age, really. Zombies, though, well, they were the first zombie film, really, was by George Romero in 1968, Night of the Living Dead. And he did it on a tiny budget and pretty much for a joke. And they got sort of taken up, and they've been popular ever since. But I don't understand why. There's just nothing serious about them. They don't say anything. They're not even that good a joke. Anyway, that's my first objection. Zombies are shit. But on to some more serious ones. The Walking Dead dystopia is artificial. Okay, so you see the occasional kitchen garden or the small field of crops, quite often with a fence around it that is so thin and feeble that a couple of zombies could easily push it over. But the characters spend almost no time thinking about sustainable production or the sort of practical business of living. It doesn't make it into the plots hardly at all. And the reason for that is just because that stuff is boring. It makes for bad TV. Viewers don't want to watch people talking about how they're going to rotate their crops this year. So food is mainly a kind of background given, an assumption. And equally assumed are where they find their fuel for their vehicles. They always seem to have vehicles and they always seem to have fuel for them. And even fresh batteries for their torches, despite the fact that there's no mains electricity. And they rarely get any sort of diseases or epidemics or anything like that to complicate things. So they don't really need much in the way of medicine. But, you know, who watches fantasy shows for realism anyway? So on to point three. Within the fantasy, there are quite deep and insidious messages about real life. The show positions capitalism as the ideal golden age society. Everything that follows that society must be worse. So be glad that you're living in capitalism. Be glad that you've got it. And if you ever have to rebuild society from scratch, obviously that's the one you're going to build. And any other possibility is effectively closed off by assuring you that, in my fourth objection, utopias are intrinsically unstable. Now, utopias do exist in The Walking Dead, and whenever the characters discover one of these walled-in Shangri-Las, it always turns out that there's something fatally wrong with them. Either these happy Arcadian Eloi turn out to be Morlocks in disguise who are planning to kill them and eat them, or they're too soft and pacifist for their own good, and they just can't stand up to some half-hearted outside attack. Or perhaps some inside betrayal. So what always happens is that they find these Shangri-Las. The whole thing falls apart in chaos and gore. And then, of course, they have to wander off looking for the next Shangri-La. So the message we get is utopias don't last. And we know they can't last, in fact, because that would be the end of the show. And there needs to be another series after this. From which I derive a further obvious point. Number five, fiction is not reality. I know that sounds idiotic, but follow my reasoning. There can't be a happy ever after in fiction, not when you're running series after series. Plots demand constant twists, so characters have to display edgy behaviour that would put probably out of place in reality, and they have to make decisions that distort our perspective of how people are. So in the show, nobody really trusts anybody. Even when things are going well, you know, somebody is going to wreck it somehow, sooner or later. And the message we get is humans can't really be trusted to cooperate and work together. Someone will always mess it up. From this follows my sixth point. Naturally, this feeds into a constant obsession with leaders and followers. So, of course, it goes without saying in the show that every group has to have a leader, even if this leader is a deranged, power-mad psychopath. And you ask yourself, well, in that case, why doesn't the group, because they have guns and things, why doesn't the group just shoot this power mad psychopath? And, you know, if they must have a leader, elect someone more reasonable. And there are no particular riches to acquire. This is a quite desolate landscape. You know, wealth is counted in tins of peaches and things like this. There's not much incentive to be some leader's stooge. But nobody ever questions the need for these leaders. And among our particular hero group, there are actually quite a number of strong characters who, in terms of the way the characters are portrayed, could easily take the lead. They're certainly strong enough to do that, but they never do, because leadership is not something they ever challenge. It's just a convenient plot device. It's never the point at issue, it's just assumed. And this is to do with the way, I think this is a lot to do with how capitalism creates popular fiction in its own image. I mean, when was the last time you saw a story or read a story that didn't have a single hero or heroine in the centre of it, around which everything and everyone revolved? So capitalist fiction, I think, is a very distinct type of fiction. It has a hierarchy, it has a single leader at the top. The idea of running a show with an ensemble of democratic players, if you like, is not unfeasible. It could be done, but it never seems to occur to the showrunners. The message is always, when the chips are down, when things are getting rough, follow your leader. That's the correct logical human response to any crisis. Which brings me to my last point, point seven, which is that the overriding message of this show is that humans are not the noble savages of Rousseau, when, if you take civilization away, humans actually become more civilized. They're the nasty and brutish Hobbesian archetypes who, when you take away the rule of capitalist law, simply turn what might be potentially a Garden of Eden into Lord of the Flies, into a hellhole. And, you know, the message overall is, well, that's just who we are. We need authority, we need governments, we need the police. And incidentally, guess what job the heroic leader had before the zombie apocalypse started? That's right, he was a policeman. So, finally, now I know that people will say, yes, all right, but you could say this about a lot of TV shows. And yes, all right, you probably could. It's the hidden curriculum, if you like, of popular culture. It's possible to watch TV shows like this and put that hidden curriculum to one side. You recognise it, you go, okay, that's just the show's stereotypical assumptions, and you can park those on a shelf and still enjoy the show's other merits. But, of course, TV doesn't really encourage critical viewing. It just wants you to slurp it all up, hidden messages and all. And I think it's interesting to look at or think about the kinds of messages we're sort of slurping in with our diet of fiction or whatever it is we watch on the TV. Do we even recognise all of those messages? You must know what I'm talking about. You must have noticed the same sort of thing I'm talking about in shows that you've seen. So, okay, there we go. That's me. Now's your chance to hold these messages up to scrutiny and see which ones you can identify. All right, so it's over to you.
Are we using the speaking cue, Paddy?
If you want to, yeah.
I don't. I thought that was a tirade I've ever heard.
Right, we're going to use the speaking cue. Steve, so you use the speaking cue. How about that? Mike, because Mike started. He's better behaved than you are. Mike Foster.
Thanks very much for your talk, Paddy. I found it very interesting. This kind of thing's right up my street. I love that kind of stuff. Although I haven't seen The Walking Dead. Whereas if it had been made, you know, sort of 50 years ago, it would be on my list of most watched programs. My TV viewing habits tend to prefer the 70s and 80s stuff. A big fan of Survivors. That's a great TV show. The original, not so much the remake, which, as you say, sort of fell flat. I won't drone on too long about Survivors because obviously your talk's focused on The Walking Dead, so I'll make a couple of points about that in a bit. But yes, Survivors even without seeing The Walking Dead, I'm sure it's got the edge over it, because it does go into raising questions about self-organization. Quite a few of the episodes are set in sort of communes with, you know, a ragbag, a group of survivors of the pandemic, and a lot of the episodes are focused on how different personalities work together with their experiences and skills. It also brings in sort of themes like sort of post-traumatic stress disorder, sort of psychological implications of how people cope with sort of their lives being turned upside down. So it is quite thoughtful, and very much in that sort of BBC sort of 70s sort of tone. But with the Walking Dead and sort of zombie fiction in particular, you mentioned the George Romero films, and I think from that several people sort of overanalyzed those films and maybe read into them more than they should. There's some parallels between Night of the Living Dead and the Civil Rights Movement around about the same time, and Dawn of the Dead, the sequel, is set in a shopping mall, and it makes comparisons between zombies and consumers. But I think those parallels are, you can't sort of look too deeply on them, but I think that sort of primed audiences to try and sort of look at something deeper in the whole zombie craze than is perhaps there. So maybe that's why zombies have sort of still got a bit of a sort of kudos, if you like, in sort of that kind of post-apocalyptic fiction. My own take on sort of post-apocalyptic fiction in general, and of course there's lots of different examples and types of that, but I think that's again sort of been implanted into our culture right from early religions. Christianity, of course, has got the tribulation and the and what it describes as the sort of chaotic society in the last days, and that's also mirrored in even earlier religions like Zoroastrianism. So a lot of the major religions have got this end time scenario, which I think has sort of fed into our culture, and sort of translates in more modern times as this post-apocalyptic fiction. But I'll leave it there anyway. But that was interesting, and lots of things to think about, Paddy. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Just a couple of quick things before I go to Paula. Yeah, what you said about that was interesting. What you said, Mike, you mentioned that in Survivors there are communes and things like that. Yeah, there are things like that in Walking Dead, but these are the sort of utopias that I'm talking about. They never seem to work. They always sort of, they're always well intentioned, but they always collapse for one reason or another. I like the thing about the Romero, the Night of the Living Dead being overanalyzed. I think there's always this tendency, isn't it, for people to say it can't just be a silly thing, it's just for fun. It must mean something. So it's sort of like, sociologists at play. You know, they're always trying to analyze things like this. Sometimes it just is silly. You made a really good point about the last days and end times. That's a really popular riff for, I think, every age. We've got it at the moment with Extinction Rebellion and this sort of thing. This is the biblical end times. I'm just reading a book about called Millennium, about 1000 AD, where they were all sort of hypnotized by the idea that the Antichrist was about to arrive. Same sort of thing. Fascinating. Never seems to get old, that end times thing. Anyway, Paula's next.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can, yeah.
Excellent. I really enjoyed The Walking Dead, but only up to a point. I think probably about season 5 or 6, and then I just found it really, really boring. And I think partly it was because it was too much of a kind of soap opera where the focus was on the humans. But unfortunately, the humans were all really annoying and boring. but anyway, that's just my view on that particular programme. But it is, you didn't mention this, Paddy, but it is based on a series of comic books, which are quite good. Because I liked it, the TV programme so much at the beginning that I went and bought the comic books, and I do like them a lot better, actually. So the whole thing about zombies is, I agree with you, Paddy. I just think they're just not interesting, are they? You know, these creatures that shamble around, and they're just there, you know, for people to, you know, cut their heads off and do really gruesome things to them. They're just not interesting. But I've read a couple of books, actually, which are written from the zombie perspective that I thought were really interesting. The first was a short story by, I think it was Michelle Faber. And that was told from the point of, so it was basically, it's set in London, and there's a virus, and it turns some people into zombies, which means that what they do is they just walk around very slowly, and they've got no control. It's kind of like that they just must keep walking. And then if they smell somebody alive, they've got to go and eat them. But inside, in their brains, they're like, ah, I don't want to eat someone. And they're horrified. They're just completely trapped, but they've got no will. They've got no control over their bodies. And there's one character who, she's in her bare feet, but she's just walking along the pavement, walking all over cut glass and everything else. There's people walking with broken legs, and they're in agony, but they can't do anything about it because they're zombies now. So I thought that was quite an interesting take on it. Another book was by the Swedish writer, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Lindqvist. He also wrote Let the Right One In, which was about vampires. But this is a novel it's called Handling the Undead. And that's where, again, it seems to be some kind of virus. But what happens is, there's some kind of storm or something, or some kind of electrical energy, or something goes wrong with the sun. And all the people who die on a certain day, they're all in their mortuaries and all the rest of it. But then they just turn up back home. You know, so they're people who've actually died and been certified dead, and then they just turn up back home. But they can't speak. And the relatives are really upset because they're like, oh, what do I do with this person now who's just standing there? So with it being Sweden, they build a big sort of like compound for them, and they house them all, and they try to look after them. and all the poor relatives are kind of like, oh. I suppose it's a bit of a metaphor for Alzheimer's, actually. Anyway, that's just, I don't like the whole Romero thing, you know, where I don't know, zombies just seem to be there for us to inflict violence on them. I much prefer that kind of more modern twist where it's told from the perspective of the zombie. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Paula. that's quite interesting. If zombies had this kind of inner life, inner consciousness, and they couldn't control their own actions, then I suppose you could see how that might be used as a sort of allegory for the position of the working class, I suppose. But you know, I still sort of think, yeah, they're just basically silly. I mean, actually, the whole idea of raising the dead, I mean, it comes from starts in the Bible, doesn't it? And it was quite a big thing in voodoo. And the word zombie entered the English language in 1819 through the poetry of Robert Southey, of all people, according to Wikipedia. So there we go. All right, so Dougie's next.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting. I've not really seen The Walking Dead, but I mean, just thinking of the television I watch, you know, sort of, and William Golding's, you know, sort of Lord of the Flies. I think it was written just after the Second World War or whatever, and after, you know, Auschwitz and different things, and he had a very bad view of human nature. I think he was a Catholic as well, so the original sin came into it. But I mean, just like thinking of, sort of things that are a bit different, you know, like Star Trek, the first series of Star Trek, every time they found a kind of utopian thing, there was always a flaw in it or whatever, you know, there would always be something wrong, you know. They'd have rules that if you walked on the grass you had to be shot or something like that, you know, even although they seem to be living a utopian life on this planet or whatever. And also you've got series like Humans that's just recently, you know, where it's about artificial intelligence. I'm more interested in that kind of aspect, right, rather than zombies, right, you know, because it is quite interesting how we deal with artificial intelligence, you know, so androids, and then you've got all the other films, you know, about you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger films, Terminator and things. So I think things are moving in that direction rather than zombies. I mean, I think zombies are old hat, right, you know.
Yeah, I would have said they were old hat, really. Yeah, surely they've played out. There's nothing more interesting you can do with them. But I mean, Paula said that Walking Dead got a bit boring in season five, and I think it sort of had ups and downs. You know, fans complained sometimes some series were sort of better than others, really. But you just don't. I don't see the appeal. Like I say, you can see why sort of vampires have got a kind of perennial appeal in a way, but and also the thing about utopias, Doug, that you were saying, Dougie. I mean, yeah, no, they're sort of impossible by definition, aren't they? You know, if you present a fictional utopia in a show, it has to be impossible because, you know, I suppose the implication otherwise is why aren't we living in it? A couple of comments there. Darren next.
Oh, excuse me, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm outside my comfort zone. I'll watch the first season, Walking Dead. Don't mind it, but I just never kept on watching. I'm just curious to those who watch it. I understand, there's been a prequel? Is that right? Was it like a prequel to The Walking Dead?
I think it's more of a paraquel, if that's even a word. Yeah.
Then that just totally negates what I was going to ask. So I was just curious if there is some underlying sort of assumption to, even if it's subconscious, what the producers are trying to say. I was just wondering if it was fleshed out more in the you know, this parallel show. But that's all I was going to ask.
No, it's just it's the same story, a different bunch of people. I mean, that's the problem with it. It just gets very repetitive after a while, you know. It becomes quite formulaic.
Just back on what Stuart said, it was really interesting, Paula's contribution, you know, especially the short story. So I'm definitely going to look out for that. It's Michelle Faber. Yeah, it's kind of, because that is kind of interesting when certain kind of themes so get a twist on them, you know, if they're popular enough, you know. So that'll be, I'm definitely looking out for that. Thank you.
Yeah, and there was a show on BBC not very long ago about zombies who, there was some new cure that you could bring zombies back from being zombies. I think I watched one episode and found it so slow and tedious that I didn't bother. But people are always still trying to riff off the same idea. Joel?
Hi, Paddy. Interesting stuff. You were saying about how there can be a tendency in some of these sort of apocalyptic series or films where they have this distrust of, say, what could be termed utopias. Do you think that's, can come from the writers or from the the film or TV companies, or do you think it's a combination of the two camps, this sort of not if they come across a utopia, that at some point they've got to, like you say, got to find a flaw with it, and it's got to be dismantled. I just wondered if you think the that view, as I say, comes from like the studio people or the writer, or from both of them.
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think it's probably both, actually. I suspect that that people like to put up, in these kind of shows, people like to put up the idea of a utopia as a sort of straw man, you know, something that nobody really believes in the first place. But they put it up because it's kind of this universal, this unspoken universal aspiration. And so they put them up in order to tear them down. But the other reason, the more practical reason, I think, is the one I mentioned, that you've got to keep the show running, and you can't have happy ever afters in a show that's expected to keep running, you know. So, you know, they spend half the time looking for some paradise, some Garden of Eden, some Shangri-La, and they find it, and hooray, hooray, the great, they found it, and oh dear. It's just another bust, you know, and that's kind of how it works, really. And you have to keep doing that if you're writing a hit show. So
yeah, because it's like any TV series or film, or they've got to be successful, haven't they, to realise the sort of amount of money that's been put into them. Thank you.
Okay, Freddie next.
Yes, evening all. So I don't have much of a contribution to make to this, but just picking up on the discussion so far and what you've said, find interesting, Paddy. My question really is, what is it that attracts people to that sort of thing, or that sort of programme in the first place? And I'll tell you the reason I ask. Is that, I mean, I even remember as a young boy, things like Doctor Who. I just wasn't interested in it at all. It meant, I just thought, this is just a load of nonsense. And hardly watched it at all, as I say, as a young boy. And then, perhaps in later years, things like Star Trek come along. And that never ever sort of appealed to me either. So really, the question is this sort of thing about zombies and such like. I'm not saying that people wouldn't find it interesting, but I wonder what it is that attracts people to it in the first place. And it's just a general question. I know that at times that program Peaky Blinders, that my wife she avowed by it, and I thought, oh, no, that's not for me. But then when I did watch Peaky Blinders eventually, I thoroughly enjoyed that. Thought it was a well-made, well-acted programme. But so it's just, but what is it that's interesting about these sort of dystopian type pictures? Am I missing something somewhere? That's all that I really want to say. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Freddie. Well, my answer to that would be escapism, in a word. You know, that's one of the main objectives of entertainment. And something I've noticed over the years is that a lot of my friends who read science fiction also read ancient history. It's as far, they like to read far forward or far back, you know, just not here. So I think it's to do with that, but it's also to do with one of the functions of science fiction, which I remember James Blish describing when he wrote a book about what was science fiction for, and he said something along the lines of it gives you a way to study human behaviour outside the norm in imagined situations that don't exist and probably never would exist. So it potentially lends you insight, if it's well done, into human behaviour or new insights into it. Okay, so Steve Finch next.
Oh yeah. Slightly follows on from the same. But no, from a very different angle. I was just wondering. As you know, Mr. Comrade Shannon, I don't have a telly. But when I did watch the bloody stuff as a kid, I'm just trying to think of, did anybody... Right, I bet you've all watched Coronation Street. Now, when I were a kid, that seemed like real life, right? Because for so many parallels in our working class life up in North. But the question is, does anybody ever remember a trade unionist in Coronation Street? Because I don't. The only sort of proper plebs in Coronation Street were the Ogdens, and they were the butt of all the jokes, right? Now, after I put me queue in the queue, it suddenly occurred to me that I do remember from that sort of a period two examples of trade unionists. One of them was in a Carry On film, which I think was Carry On, I'm All Right, Jack, or something like that. And the other was The Rag Trade, where Miriam Carlin played a shop steward. And she was... But these were people, they were absolute caricatures. And they were people, they were the butt of all the fun. So to draw this into what Freddie was saying, this stuff is just absolute distraction. This is bread and circuses for the modern age. It's as simple as that. And I really don't think that we're ever going to see any, with the occasional Mike Lee film, I don't think we're going to see much discussion about real life for workers. Anyway, thanks, that's it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't disagree with that, but I think there's good in these things as well. I mean, if you look at, you mentioned Coronation Street, I don't remember there being a union organiser in it either, but there was certainly a bad employer, Mike Baldwin, who's just actually, the actor's just died recently, I think. There were famously some top stories in, I think it was Brookside, that dealt with domestic violence and gay marriages and things like that, which were sort of, you know, they were newsworthy because they were ahead of the trend. And my feeling is that actually things like soaps particularly have normalised sort of gender difference and, you know, sort of sexual preference and things like that for the mainstream. And they're probably one of the main drivers of changes of attitudes in the population towards those things. So, not saying that any of these things are revolutionary, but I don't think that they are completely without influence and that they're completely without merit either. And just to add a rider to the question about the union organising in Coronation Street, I was once trying to think of an example of where Proudhon's description of capitalism existed. There was he had this idea that, you know, capitalism would be a lot of basically small traders. Everyone owns their little, you know, their stall or their little shop or something like that, and it's all quite small. You don't have these multinationals. Everybody's a sort of sole trader, or pretty much. Maybe they've got one assistant or something like that. And the one place where I thought, actually, this does exist. This really does exist. Proudhon's capitalism does exist, and where it exists is in Albert Square in EastEnders. At a show I haven't watched in donkey's years, but it certainly did at the time. And I thought that was quite interesting that they'd invented a sort of pseudo-capitalism, an idealised capitalism for the show, which has never actually existed in reality. OK, so next is Mike Foster again. Mike.
Cheers. With Steve's point, and maybe this... says more about my sort of taste in pop culture than anything, but the Carry On film you mentioned was 1971's Carry On at Your Convenience, set in a lavatory factory. And yeah, you're quite right. The one of the main characters is the union rep, and he's portrayed as a, you know, sort of a clown who's obsessed with the rule book, and you know, sort of doesn't see the wood for the trees. At the time that film had was less popular than other Carry On films because the audience didn't really a big section of the audience didn't appreciate being sort of poked fun of in that way. That wasn't my main point. But again, it was to answer what or hopefully answer what Freddie and Steve were saying about what the appeal of this kind of fiction is, and dystopias, the sort of the aim of them, or sort of decent ones, of course, is to take something that's sort of irritating or worrying in our society and extrapolate what would happen if that annoying thing became dominant. You know, 1984 is the obvious example, not only for what it says about politics, but things like, you know, being constantly watched. How language is manipulated. It takes sort of a thread that was being talked about at the time and sort of blows it all up out of all proportion as part of a sort of a slippery slope argument. And of course, you don't get that only in dystopias, but other science fiction, sort of one example off the top of my head would be Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which was a parallel of fears of McCarthyism. Again, like with the George Romero films, that's probably been overanalyzed they're not quite zombies, but they're sort of aliens have taken over people and turned them into sort of mindless drones. And you know, the comparison there is with the commies infiltrating America. But yeah, you can overplay that metaphor, but that was a deliberate one. So yeah, I think some of the appeal of that kind of fiction is like a thought experiment to see what would happen if something annoying in society became dominant. And I think that's sort of the one way to read them, but you know, a few fights and a few sort of spectacles, if it helps to sort of sugar the pill, then that could be part of the enjoyment of them as well. Cheers.
Well, thanks, Mike. Just by coincidence, I was just listening to In Our Time, Melvin Bragg's thing, BBC's podcasts, and it was on the Time Machine, and H.G. Wells, 1895, and so. You know, in this story, the time traveller goes 800,000 years into the future, and I'm sure you all know the story. He arrives in a sort of Garden of Eden populated by these beautiful but really quite stupid and monosyllabic humans who just float around eating strawberries and things. And then, of course, he finds out that they're being predated on by these underground, white, hideous sort of derivatives of humans called Morlocks, who just hunt them and eat them. And Melvin Bragg's experts were saying that this was Wells making his take on class conflict, on the class war, and. Like you said, Mike, extrapolating one thing from the present and sort of blowing it up to a whole society and sort of making a point really about present society by presenting a quite hideous utopia. So same sort of thing. Okay, Darren.
Yeah, just a couple of points really from Steve's contribution. You know, Mike's already mentioned the Carry On film. I think Steve referred to it as Carry On, I'm All Right, Jack. I think he's conflated that with a really brilliant film called I'm All Right, Jack, which is a piss take of the trade unions from the late 50s. And it's arguably one of Peter Sellers' best ever films. And I should recommend to anybody if they get a chance to see it, because Peter Sellers plays a character called Fred Kite, who's like this, like, just really daft, like, communist shop steward. And, you know, you could argue it's like anti-unions. I actually think there's a subtler message there, you know, like quite clever. On Coronation Street, you know, I don't know why I remember this, but there was a strike at Mike's factory, actually Mike Baldwin's factory. I do remember it. It was like the early 80s, I guess. and for a couple of episodes, it was quite political, and this would have been at a time when Coronation Street was like watched by like 20 million, 21 million people. Steve mentioned Stan Ogden, the Ogdens. This is like one of these things, it's unbelievable when you hear it, but when Stan Ogden originally was introduced as a character in Coronation Street, he was actually written as an international brigader. He was actually someone who'd actually fought in the International Brigade in the Spanish Civil War. And part of the reason that was written in is because one of the writers of the Coronation Street at the time was a guy called Jim Allen, a Trotskyist TV writer and screenwriter who's probably best known for his work with Ken Loach. He was the guy who wrote the screenplay for Land and Freedom, again about the Spanish Civil War, wrote a lot of play for Today's in the 70s, like The Big Flame, Spongers, Rank and File, wrote Rain and Stones, that's a good film. And Paddy mentioned Brookside, and he's been in the news. I've seen in the last couple of days Ricky Tomlinson because of the overturning of the Shrewsbury conviction from the early 70s when he was an active trade unionist and he was kind of like set up, him and Des Warren. Well, his character in Brookside was a shop steward, and part and parcel of his character was, you know, basically expressing the opinions of a shop steward, you know, at the time, you know, there was elements of like scabbing and et cetera. It was a bit didactic at time. I would have been a bit young, probably about 12 or 13 when I watched it. And on the issue of like stuff like trade unionists, trade unions in TV, I don't know if this show is shown in Britain, probably on some channel. There's an American sitcom right now called Superstore. It was made by the guy who did Parks and Recreation. It's a really funny show, and one of the storylines that they've ran with for like a season and a half is their attempts to unionize the store. And the worst thing in the world, I think, is when people try to be didactic and try to be worthy and try to make the case for like why people should be class conscious, or you know, why they should be socialists or why they should be trade unionists. So they've done it with humor, and as a consequence, it probably brought a lot of people with them. And, you know, if people get a chance to see this, you know, as an example of where you're trying to sort of insert about class politics, if you like, in a popular show where, you know, you can sugar the pill a bit, you know, it's definitely worth watching, you know. Superstore, one word, it's like fourth or fifth season, I think. And another show, yeah, sorry, the same guy works on The Office, the American version of The Office, as I remember. And I remember they had one episode, which was all about the Scranton branch of The Office, where the warehouse was threatening to unionize. And it was a brilliant episode. Again, if you get a chance, I might try and find it on YouTube and post some links, useful links, how management was able to shut it down so quickly. It was instructive, you know, and it's, you know, there's definitely purpose in sort of putting these storylines into shows to basically tell people what goes on, you know, what actually goes on, you know. And I think it probably communicates far to a far greater audience than somebody like me, like trying to sell a paper on the street corner, etc. But yeah, just a couple of things that sprung to mind that have nothing to do with The Walking Dead, so I'll stop talking. Thank you.
Thanks, Darren. Well, it doesn't matter. We can wander away. We can walk away from The Walking Dead. That's fine. Paula.
Yeah, just following on from what Darren was saying, Superstore is on Netflix, 5 seasons. So we can all go and watch it after this meeting. Those of us that have got Netflix, that is. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, if you've got Netflix, there you go. Yeah, Darren made a point, actually, about something, your TV can't be didactic, and that's a thing, isn't it, with TV. Well, I suppose with art, generally, I hesitate to get onto such a big subject, but... I think probably most people agree that art can't really be didactic, or at least not blatantly so. I suppose it has to kind of, the most it can do is sort of nudge rather than push. And even to do that, it has to sort of connect with what the audience knows, what the audience believes. So these sort of social issues can pop up in shows, but clearly they can't make a huge issue out of them. They have to just kind of pick them as sort of topical moments in order to keep the show going. So nobody else in the queue at the moment. Anybody else got any thoughts? Howard?
Since nobody else is speaking, just a quick word about one or two of the points you made, Paddy, in what I thought was a very interesting, very instructive introduction. I thought one or two of your comments were a bit sweeping. You were talking about fiction as a sort of broad generalisation. In the way you were suggesting it, it always presents people as needing leaders. It always sort of presents people as being mistrustful of one another and in conflict with one another. It may well be true of a fiction like The Walking Dead and other such things on the sort of, you know, on visual media, but it isn't true of fiction generally. I mean, of what you might call good written fiction. It may be, you know, it depends on who the writer is, but very often you couldn't really generalise it to the extent of saying that's an inevitable characteristic and it's there somehow to, you know, to push the capitalist ethic of leadership and conflict and so on. All sorts of different sort of fictions which do all sorts of different things. And, you know, I agree with Darren, the best fiction of any kind is always fiction that doesn't seek to proselytize, doesn't work when you try and do that. It's always best when things sort of emerge naturally, as it were, from you know, what happens or what people happen to say to one another. I also wanted to mention The Archers as an interesting fiction from various points of view, but what I had to say about it was a bit complex, and I'm not sure if I've got it straight in my own mind, so I'll leave that for the moment anyway. If I work it out in the next few minutes, I might come back.
Okay, thanks, Howard. Yeah, you probably can come back because... yeah, there's nobody else speaking. But just on your what you're saying about, you're probably right, I am being very sweeping about fiction. I mean, I was mainly talking about that particular show. I wasn't so much talking about general fiction. But I'd still think I'd defend what I said about capitalist fiction. I do think that, to a large extent, capitalism... you know, forms its entertainment in its own image, and it sort of almost forces us to think about fiction in capitalist terms. And I don't just mean in terms of money and stuff like that. I mean even in the way it describes utopias and dystopias and things like this and the very form of the novel. I'm quite interested in novels and how they're done. And people who are in writing groups will know, if anybody's been in one, they'll probably have heard of a thing called The Hero's Journey. This is very famous amongst writers and would-be writers. It's basically a formula for how to write a good story. And the story of The Hero's Journey, the evolution of it, is quite a fascinating one. It derived from some, I can't remember who it was, somebody who did a study of folklore tales, Russian I think they were, did a huge number of studied a huge number of folklore tales in order to sort of establish what they had in common. And this was published in the late 40s, or I think, as a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. So now the clue's in the title, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. So The common denominators of all these stories, and you can include fairy stories, Grimm's fairy tales, you know, all these kind of things, is that the hero goes on a journey. They're called to they receive a call to adventure, which they typically first of all refuse, but then they're persuaded to do it. Then they go through a sort of threshold process. Then they go out of their normal world into a strange world. Then they meet challenges and they acquire assistance and helpers. They go through a sort of revelation process, a transformation process. They hit their darkest hour, often represented by their actual or apparent death. And then they're sort of resurrected, more powerful than before, achieve their goal, the Holy Grail or whatever it is. The book ends on this highlight. And this was introduced to Hollywood by a 14-page memo, famously written on the equivalent of Post-it notes. And Hollywood executives got very excited about this. Jane and Tony just said Joseph Campbell. That's right, that's who it was. They got very excited by this. And out of this came what's now become the sort of Hollywood model for how to do a good story. But the thing about it is, it's always one hero. It's always the lone hero. They have helpers, they have, you know, buddies and things like this, but it's always about the one hero. And this is the leadership mentality or culture, if you like, of capitalism enshrined in its storytelling to this day. And that's what imbues most novel writing, at least that's not sort of, you know, literary fiction. These are, you know, the type of novel that's written to sell basically uses this formula. Howard wants to come back. So, yeah, go on, Howard.
Yeah, you did say that. Yeah, I sort of appreciate what you're saying with regard to what might be called popular fiction. There's a lot of fiction that, you know, is sort of on the borderline between popular and literary, which doesn't follow this itinerary of, the hero's journey. I mean, I'm just thinking of a couple of things I've read recently. There's a novel called Capital by John Lanchester, which is serialized on television. And, far from being a hero's journey, it's a sort of heel's journey, really. This sort of idiotic fellow who thinks he's going to sort of make a fortune by being in a highly paid job in the city. And then suddenly the whole firm goes bust, but, you know, his wife has got used to a high life and, you know, she's going to leave him because he's not bringing the money in, et cetera, et cetera. Real mess. Brilliant novel. Another excellent novel, which I can think of, read not long ago, is one called Stoner by John Williams. Other people may have read it. An American writer. I mean, it's the story of an obscure university lecturer in the States who sort of leads a very obscure life and has a sort of fairly obscure death. Doesn't sound very interesting, but it's a brilliant novel. It's excellently written. Nothing of the sort of hero's journey there either. There are loads and loads of these. So, as I say, I do appreciate that, you know, what you're saying has substance, but, it is possible to overgeneralize.
I'll just reply to that quickly because nobody else is in the queue. I did say, you know, this is not necessarily true of sort of literary fiction. I'm talking about, yeah, popular fiction generally, but that's kind of the vast bulk of books that are written and books that are read, in fact. So and film and TV, in fact, you know, all sort of follow this because it sells. So and this is what I suppose I mean by capitalism creating its entertainment, its own image. You know, it creates what sells, and that's what sells because people are sort of, you know, quite hypnotized by this idea of the hero. So, literary efforts notwithstanding, really.
Could I just say, Paddy, that you're cutting out a bit now and then?
Oh, really?
Okay. No, it's okay. I mean, it's not that we're not sort of following what you're saying, but just to tell you about that anyway.
Okay. All right, so anybody else? Oh, Mike Foster.
Say something about what you mentioned about, you know, the hero's journey in fiction. And I suppose with speculative fiction, both the sort of dystopia and utopia type, it's not so much about the hero making choices and going off in a certain direction in their life. It's where sort of society as a whole makes some sort of choice, or, you know, or whoever's ruling society or whatever, whatever shapes society. So it shifts the it's about society sort of choices and where that road takes them. So the and of course you've got sort of heroes within that, if that's what the author chooses to do. But yeah, I think the difference between a lot of other sort of literary fiction and speculative fiction is it sort of shifts the scope away from the individual more towards society. That's just something that popped into my head. Another thing that popped into my head is back on the old zombie theme is someone's rewritten Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, presumably because the copyrights run out, as Pride and Prejudice with Zombies. Haven't read it myself, but I think it sold quite well, and there's been a few sort of copycat books. So I don't know what happens. I'm guessing it takes the basic plot of Pride and Prejudice, and all of a sudden there's a tap on the window and there's a zombie outside. I think that's the gist of it. I don't know if anyone else has picked up on that, but I suppose that's an interesting spin on the zombie invasion of popular culture. It's chomping into books of long ago and making them undead as well. Cheers.
Yeah, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Yes, it's Jane Austen interspersed with sentences like, of course, you know, he would make a very good match, said Mrs. Simpson, shouldering her Armalite. And his sister is excellent at Kung Fu. So it's all like that. I tried to read about half of it, and it was quite funny for about the first chapter, but it started to get a bit, all right, okay, I think I'd probably rather just read Jane Austen in the original. But the film's quite good. There is a film, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, that's quite funny. Just your other point, Mike, what you were saying about sometimes it's not so much the hero making choices, it's society that's changing. Yeah, okay, yeah, that's true. But in story writing, you quickly make a distinction between what's called the setup and what's the plot. And the setup is what's going on in society at large, and the plot is what the hero or the main characters are doing. So you can spend an awful lot of time making notes about what your society is doing, and that's your setup. But you haven't got a plot until you've got some main characters and what they're doing. So, you know, it never is about, you know, the society. That's the kind of background to your main drama. So, any other thoughts, or are you going to have an early night tonight? Okay, well, all right. You're obviously all stunned into silence by the sheer erudition of the contributions this evening. I'm pleased to see. So, I guess we may as well wrap it up.
Thanks, Paddy. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Even if people didn't have a lot to say.
All right, then. Okay. Well, next, we're having the talk on Friday is on industrial revolutions. So we return from the ridiculous back to the sublime.
So is it a wrap then, Paddy?
I reckon so.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. See you all on Friday.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Thanks. Ciao, guys.
I'll see you again.